Well, good morning. It is now 11:30, time for our class to begin. Thank you again for joining us this morning for our Building Your Life for God class. Today we're going to pick up and continue part two of the book of Esther, as we've been studying for this now the past 2 weeks. And I want to remind everyone again that I will be sending out the Bible class material via the email distribution capabilities through the church website and Congregate earlier this week. And for the next 2 weeks after today, we'll be studying the book of Ezra. And so I'll be sending that out. We'll break Ezra into two parts like we've done Esther, and we'll do part one of Ezra next week. And then the week after, we'll finish up the second part of the book of Ezra. So this morning, we're going to conclude our study here on the book of Esther. And again, you can email me directly at the email there on the screen if for some reason you're not receiving the class materials, or if you have questions or want any more information. I'm glad to share with you my PowerPoints or my notes or anything like that. All right. So that being said, let's go ahead and get into it here. And we'll review a little bit what we talked about last week to give ourselves a little bit of context for going into this part two today. And so we remember, and again, we could probably spend and have spent in the past a whole quarter on the book of Esther. So this is very much summary information, and we're not getting into every detail or every bit of the context or the story that's contained in the entire book, but just kind of doing a summary overview of the book. And so Esther was chosen to be queen after Queen Vashti was deposed for refusing the king's order to come before him and his men during a feast that he was having. And so when she disobeyed that order, remember, the king held a beauty pageant, if you will, and Esther was chosen to be queen because she was beautiful. And so later on in the story, we remember Mordecai, who's her cousin, learned of a plot to assassinate the king. And through Esther, now in her role as queen, he communicates that information to her, and she is able to help foil the plot by informing the king about what's going to happen. And that story is going to be critical in our story today as we look at chapter 6 through the end of the book, with this one little deed done by Mordecai to help save the king's life become significant. Well, there's a man named Haman, as you remember, who is second in command in the kingdom, the king Ahasuerus, and he hates Mordecai. The king had declared that all men should bow down and pay homage to Haman, and Mordecai refuses to do that. And so in his refusal to do that, Haman is angry and plots to kill Mordecai, and not just Mordecai, but also all of his people, the Jews. And so when Mordecai learns about this, he again goes to Esther, the queen, and pleads with her to tell the king about what Haman is plotting against him, her, and their people. And so Esther, after speaking with Mordecai and him encouraging her to take this vital opportunity that she has to save her people, she risks her life and requests the presence of the king to go before him and try to save her people. And so she does that. And what she does when she goes before the king is she requests to have a banquet. And so she asks that the king and his right-hand man, Haman, come to a banquet. And so Haman is very happy, very excited about coming to this banquet, that he's been honored to be in the presence of the queen and the king, and that he alone has been invited. And so he goes around, tells all his friends and family about this wonderful treat that he has to be able to come and do this. And so in the process, on his way home from this banquet that is given, informing him of another banquet that is to come, he sees Mordecai at the gate, and his hatred for him is still brewing. And so he has gallows built upon which he wants to hang Mordecai. And so in the morning, Haman had planned to go to the king and inform him of his plan to hang Mordecai. But as we'll see now in our text, there is a dramatic role reversal about to happen. And so let's get into our class here. Let me pause for 1 minute. I've got several people asking me here online about how they can get into the class. Let me just respond to one of these real fast. And if you're having any difficulties, please let me know with accessing this, or if people are pinging you and telling you they can't get on, let me know and I'll see what I can do to try and make that available to them. Sorry to take that moment, but I'm going to respond to them, let them know what we're doing. Okay, so the first section of our text starts in Esther chapter 6 in verses 1 through 11. And very interesting story here. Let's go ahead and read the text and then we'll have some comments on it. And it says, on that night, and this is the night after the first banquet that Esther had thrown, the king could not sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles. And they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. And the king said, who is in the court? And now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. And so Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, and let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. And so Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. What a dramatic role reversal. Can you imagine Haman coming to the king in the morning? Him and the king have seemed to agree on everything. Haman has gotten his way and just about everything that he's asked the king for up until now. He's got this plan to kill the Jews. He's got this plan to hang Mordecai. And now the king one night can't sleep, and his bedtime reading of choice is the historical chronicles of what has happened in the kingdom. And through the reading of this, he remembers Mordecai and what Mordecai had done to save his life. And how else does the king choose to honor Mordecai but by using the very man Haman, who hates him so badly, who is seeking to kill him? Haman is now forced to be that one to bestow the king's honor upon the man that he hates. Can you imagine Haman in his pride and in his self-centric thinking having to do this, and how humiliating that would have been for him, and how much anger that would have stirred up inside of him even more toward Mordecai? And so in our questions for the week, we've talked about some of these, but when the king couldn't sleep, he learned from the book of records about Mordecai. He was reminded about this man that had saved his life, and used Haman to honor him for that deed. Not sure why the king couldn't sleep that night. He had just had a wonderful banquet, probably stuffed himself full. There was drinking and all kinds of things going on. You would have thought maybe after that banquet, he would have been ready to go to bed and would have slept very well for a long time, but he couldn't sleep. And that one event in his life of not being able to sleep, and then the book of the Chronicles being read, is a big turning point here in the life of Mordecai and in the plan to save the Jews. Because now Mordecai is going to start to take upon himself a position of honor and favor with the king, as Haman's honor and favor with the king starts to be reduced and then destroyed in his death. And we'll see that as we move on in the story here. Any comments or questions on this section here in chapter 6? If you have a comment or a question, you can definitely unmute yourself and verbally ask that question or make that comment, or you can use the chat feature if you wish and chat me the question that way. All right, let's move on to the second section here. And now we turn to chapter 7. And so now the second banquet that Esther has planned is going to occur. The first banquet was just to make the king and Haman aware that she wanted to throw them a second banquet. And so now this second banquet comes to pass in chapter 7. And so it says, so the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." And then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And if we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Then King Ahasuerus said to Esther, "Who is he? And where is he? And who has dared to do this?" And Queen Esther said, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. One interesting thing as we look at this section of the story in the first six verses of chapter 6 is one thing that's always come to my mind as I've read this now over and over is the king is interesting here in that he says to the queen, "What is your wish? What is your request? Even to half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." And I find that interesting that a king would be willing to give up half of his kingdom to his queen, who probably hasn't been queen very long, and will make that subject to any request that she has. We find this several times with leaders of nations doing things like this. I'm reminded of the time when Herod, you know, asks or grants the wish, and it turns out to be that John the Baptist's head comes on a platter. These kings sometimes during these banquets had obviously seemed to lose their sense of not just right and wrong, but also their ability to reason and their ability to understand the gravity of the moment and what they were giving up. But nonetheless, the king says to Esther that he will grant her a wish that's up to half his kingdom. And so this is where Esther boldly with courage stands up and says, "There's a plot to kill me and my people, to wipe us out. And we're not just being sold as slaves. This is a plot to actually wipe out the nation of the Jews." And so the king is astonished at this, wants to know, who is this? Where are they? Who dared to do this? And Esther, there in the room, can point right next to the king, to the man Haman, the foe, the enemy, the wicked Haman. And so picking up in verse 7, it says, "And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the garden palace. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?' As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, 'Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king was abated. So another complete twist in the plot here. What irony that Haman here has been exposed, and his hatred for Mordecai had caused him to prepare gallows for Mordecai's death, for Mordecai to be hanged by Haman. And now, because of what Mordecai did in saving the king, and because of his urging Esther to go to the king, and Esther's courage in doing that has exposed Haman, and his ultimate judgment is that he will be hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for his foe, Mordecai. An interesting turn of events here, quite a role reversal for Mordecai, Haman, and the Jews. And so we've just discussed these questions here, that the king commanded Haman to be hanged after he was exposed. And his wrath even was increased in this, not that he just plotted to kill the Jews, but as the king left the palace and went out to the garden to contemplate these things, when he came back, he felt like Haman was taking advantage of a situation with the queen, that he was there possibly verbally assaulting her, or pleading with her in a very aggressive manner and begging her to do something, whereas he should have been making that petition to the king, and not to Esther, because it was in the king's power to change what was going to be done to him, and he should have left Esther out of it. Esther only spoke the truth about the matter and wasn't involved in the execution of punishment upon Haman for that thing that he had done. So any questions or comments so far and what we've talked about so far in the story? Okay. All right, let's go on. All right, the next section. Okay, so we've gotten rid of Haman. Mordecai has come into the favor of the king. Esther has helped expose the plot to kill the Jews, and they seem to have gained the king's favor and her plight to reverse that from happening. And so now we're going to see how the plan unfolds, that actual saving of the Jews will come about. You remember when the king made this edict that the Jews would be killed at the urging of Haman, it was a law made, a decree made that could not be reversed. And so it's not as simple at this point as the king making a new decree to reverse that decree. It was a decree that under the law of the Persians could not be undone. And so now there has to be a plan put in place for Esther to help her people overcome the wrath that may be coming upon them. And so that's where you pick up here now. Chapter 8 and verse 1. And it says, on that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. Okay, so now Esther has told the king about her relationship with Mordecai, being family, and that they're both Jews, and they both have a very interested stake in saving these people. And so in verse 2, it says, and the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And then Esther spoke again to the king, and she fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. And skipping to verse 10, it says, and he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring. And then he sent the letters mounted by couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. And then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. And the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many of the peoples from the country declared themselves Jews for fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. So now we see Esther has gone to the king again and explained, I guess, the plight of the Jews and how they know that because of the prior decree, enemies are going to come upon them. People that are loyal to Haman, people that are natives of the land that didn't like the fact that there was a large population of Jews settled there in Persia at the time, may have had animosity toward them. And so they know an attack is coming. And so the king decrees that Jews can defend themselves in a very powerful way against these people, even to the point of killing them and plundering their goods, as is laid out in verse 11 of chapter 8. And so what we see is now Mordecai is elevated basically to the position of Haman. He's now the king's right-hand man, given the signet ring, which is the power of the king. Very important position for Mordecai to be in. And so when the people of Persia hear about this, one interesting thing to note down in verse 17 is, it says, and many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. So the people of Persia now realize that, you know, and especially people maybe that had been against Esther, Mordecai, and the Jews, had been loyal to Haman, realize the pendulum has swung now. Things are in their favor at this point. And so they are declaring themselves Jews because they're scared of what might the Jews do to them if they're exposed as enemies of the Jews. So Mordecai is praised in the capital city of Susa. The Jewish nation there that is in exile, now dwelling in Persia, it says, had light and gladness and joy and honor. And so wherever the king's edict was proclaimed about their ability to defend themselves against their demise, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. One thing that stuck out to me also in this reading is that here you have a nation of people in exile. So you have a group of Jews now living in the land of Persia. And typically you would think that people living in exile would have a hard time defending themselves. They would be a watched people. They would not be an armed people. They would not be a people that could readily raise up an army of insurrection and successfully overcome their enemies, especially enemies that are native to the land in which they are living. So a powerful thing that this group has done here in Persia, as we'll see here in the next reading, as we look at how they actually go about defending themselves. And so, again, looking at the question, it says, who did the king appoint in Haman's place? Mordecai. Again, the irony of that. Mordecai and Haman have now swapped places. Haman is hanged on the gallows. Mordecai is now in power, aligned with the king. And so the king, obviously, at Esther's request, made this law that the Jews could defend themselves. And that's exactly what they're going to do now in chapter 9. And so in chapter 9 here, it says, now on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought to harm them, who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All of the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame had spread throughout all the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. And the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased with those who hated them. And skipping down to verse 11, that very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "In Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows." And so the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. So there's a couple of interesting details in this reading. We didn't discuss this last week in our story, but at the beginning of chapter 9, when it says in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out. So you might think, okay, why did they pick this day? Why the 12th month of Adar on the 13th day? And if you go back and you reread some of those first chapters of the book and you look at what Haman did, Haman casually rolled the dice. And whatever the dice came up with, that was the day that he selected that the Jews would be destroyed. And what's interesting is the word for die is pur. P-U-R. And as you'll see as we read in this next section, once the Jews had destroyed their enemies, they establish a feast day. And they're going to call this feast day Purim. And they name the feast that quite possibly after this very fact that Haman used a die or a pur to determine their fate. And so again, another contrast here in the book of Esther between what someone tried to do to the Jews in rolling a pur or rolling a die, and then the Jews becoming victorious over their enemies and having a feast that they then name Purim. Just another irony of the book, and we didn't discuss a lot of those details from the book earlier, but I wanted to point that out here since we're talking about the time period in which this happened. That's how that was established by Haman as he went about his plan to eradicate the Jews.
Chase.
Yes.
I was wondering, before the kings sent out a decree that the Jews could defend themselves, what was it that the Jews just sat around when people were coming to kill them? They just sat and did nothing, didn't fight back. You had to have a decree to defend yourself. What's that all about?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. You know, I'm not quite sure that when people would have come to kill them, if Haman had been successful and people would have come to try and kill the Jews, they wouldn't have fought back. You know, I think it's our natural inclination as human beings to defend ourselves, especially amidst an attack like that. I think what also may be going on here is that because the Jews were exiled in the land, they were getting an endorsement here from the king to commit, you know, basically war against these clans of Haman that were coming against them. I'm not so sure that they were sitting around at this point after the decree was made by the king, that they were sitting around waiting for Haman's people to come. It's quite possible that they were also searching them out on that day. They knew the day that the edict was going to be carried out. And they knew on that day people were going to be coming after them. And after the king makes this edict allowing them to defend themselves and basically saying, "I will sanction your defense," I think that also plays into, like, in chapter 9 here, verse 3, when you've got the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors, all the government officials now and the important people in the kingdom are rallying to help the Jews, partially because of this edict of the king, I would imagine, but also it says because of the fear of Mordecai, who they know is the one helping orchestrate this there in the palace and has the ear of the king. So that may play into all of that. That's a good question, though. Let me see here. Let me pull up my chat real fast. Okay. Okay, so D, good comments here. So D a few minutes ago commented that, you know, it had been about 5 years since Mordecai had saved the king. When he finally got around to reading the Chronicles and finding out that it was Mordecai who he needed to honor. So a significant amount of time there, being about 5 years, had passed. That is true. And, you know, timing is everything in this. And sometimes, especially in the Old Testament, when we read some of these books, it's hard to get the chronology of what's going on and to put that into our own perspective of time. But 5 years is quite a while for that to have happened. And the reading of the text, it doesn't seem like it's but, you know, days or weeks afterward, but it was several years. And then Dee also brings up in verse 11, it says that they also killed the 10 sons of Haman. And then in verse 13, Esther asked them to hang the sons on the gallows. Weren't they already dead? Oh, that is a good question. And that is the chronology of how that is written. Because verse 14 says the king command, or yeah, we'll go to 13. Verse 13 says, if it please the king, tomorrow, let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. And in verse, let's see, what verse was that where it talked about that before? Oh yeah, verse 12. It says, and the king said to Esther in the Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. So it was reported by the king to Esther that the 10 sons of Haman, it says 500 men have been destroyed and also the 10 sons of Haman. That's a little bit of a conflict, you would think, in how that's being portrayed. Unless when it talks about verse 12, either the chronology is different, and verse 14 is just the explanation of how the 10 sons of Haman were dealt with, or that when it says in the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman, that maybe the interpretation there is that they killed and destroyed 500 men and they taken captive the 10 sons of Haman. I'm not sure. That's a good question.
Chase.
Yes.
Do you remember a couple of weeks ago, I think it was in Ezekiel, we were saying how that somebody ate grapes and I can't remember how it is, but what it meant was that you were suffering the consequences of somebody else. Your teeth have been set on edge. And so these 10 sons, was this before that time? Because these 10 sons don't seem to be responsible for the actions of their dad. So was this before this commandment in Ezekiel? Because it's still in the Old Testament.
So the proverb that they had in the book of Ezekiel was, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and therefore the children's teeth are set on edge. Yeah. And that was a cultural proverb, I think, of that time that is being referenced in the book of Ezekiel, talking about how the children were blaming their fathers for their situation, the punishment that they were facing and being exiled. Here, we're not quite given that. Esther seems to take place after that time. And who knows, I'm sure, just like we have today, we don't have that same proverb word for word in our society, but boy, do we like to blame other people for our bad choices and things that come upon us. So that line of thinking, that philosophy is still prevalent today. In this situation, you know, you remember that when Haman seems to have a very welcoming audience in his family, of his prideful ways, of his rise to power, I'm sure his family was loyal to him in that way. And so you can only imagine that his 10 sons being brought up with him as the second most powerful man in the kingdom, and having all of the privilege and the benefits that go along with that, had also adopted his ideology. We don't know that for certain, other than it seems that the king probably would have been aware of that. Esther probably aware of that. And therefore, there's no hesitation here on the king's part when he says, hey, let's have these 10 sons hanged for whatever their role was in this, or because their philosophy or their actions or whatever they had done was in an attempt to harm the Jews. And that's probably the best explanation I can think of here, is that it's not just guilt by association. It's not a situation where they're being punished for what their father had done, as much as we don't know their ages. We're assuming it, you know, that they're of adult age at this point, and that they have also participated and taken part in this plan to kill the Jews. Let's see. All right, Troy says, could they have been hanged to make a public example, not to kill them, but just so everyone could see they were dead? Yeah, that's definitely possible. Yeah, they could have been dead, and they could have just hung their bodies out there as a public display to show everyone that, you know, who was in control, and now that Haman's plot and everyone associated with him had finally been dealt with. So yeah, that's definitely possible. let's see. Yeah. I mean, I think same thing. D comments about maybe this be done in a public way, for everyone to see. And yeah, I think that's quite possible that, even if they were killed in the citadel in verse 12, that maybe they did make a public display of it and hung them on the gallows for people to see. That seems plausible to me, that could be a possibility of what the explanation is for the differences in those two verses. Yeah, so good comments on that. Anyone else before we move on?
You know, I keep thinking that Esther, it just seems to me to be so grateful that the king listened to her and that all of this tragedy was averted, instead of now, I mean, in praising God for that, instead of now going after some more blood, leaving well enough alone.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I think we see this, not that this is completely synonymous, but, you know, I think, you know, like when the nation of Israel came into the promised land and God instructed them to wipe out some of these nations completely, and not leave a trace of them there because of their wicked influence, with idolatry and everything else that went along with it, and how that was going to affect the Jews when they entered into the land. Maybe there's a similar thing here, in that, you know, if you had left a small group of Haman's loyalists or part of his family in place, it would just create a situation where later on down the road, the Jews were constantly living in fear that there would be another uprising among that group of people that would try and do something similar to what Haman was plotting. So it's never pleasant to think about, you know, bloodshed and, you know, wiping out a whole group of people like this that are contrary to the queen and the Jews. But there must have been a purpose for it. And that's why it's part of the historical narrative here.
Makes sense.
All right. So,
Chase.
Hey, yeah. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, I have two things. First, a general thing about the Old Testament that I think is different than the New Testament. often the Old Testament reports the facts without giving a judgment on what took place. Mm-hmm. We'll read about Solomon having multiple wives. And some passages will simply report that he had multiple wives, but we know that that wasn't good. I guess that's the first example that comes to my mind. Often when we read in the Old Testament, it will report the facts without giving us a judgment. And we have to use our information to infer whether or not what took place was right or wrong. And then a second thing is all of the characters in the Old Testament are nuanced characters that aren't always good. I tend to agree with you. I definitely think that this has something to do with purifying the area, which would be a good thing and which was something that God wanted the people of Israel to do. But like even considering in other cases, these nuanced characters, they might be doing the right thing, but they might have flaws. They might have a desire for vengeance outside of God's justice or other things like that. We can think of like the judges who God made use of for the good of the kingdom, but they were all nuanced characters that weren't perfectly good people. So not everything that's reported, especially in the accounts that we have in the Old Testament, are necessarily positive things. We've got to kind of look at the details and determine based on what we know God's character to be in the context of the situation, whether or not those things were good.
Yeah, that's a good point, Paul. And definitely we see that here. And we won't go into it for purposes of this class in any kind of detail, but that's one thing that commentators like to point out about the characters of Mordecai and Esther, and that God doesn't necessarily hold them up as righteous people or holy people. Definitely they had their flaws. And there's talk, about their engagement and, banquet drinking parties and other cultural things that would have been going on in the king's palace and things like that during their time. But God used them for a specific purpose at a specific time to accomplish his purpose. And I think that goes hand in hand with what you're saying in regards to events that happened in the Old Testament.
Yeah, it always comes back to who is the hero of this story. Esther is not the hero of the story. Mordecai is not the hero of the story. Who's the hero? God is the hero. And he makes use of people in their circumstances and in their poorness of spirit and in their abilities and their lack of abilities. And he takes their lemons and turns it into lemonade, which is another thing for us to see just as Christians in general. We're all imperfect people and God can still make incredible use of us. So I think even there is something for us to consider these imperfect characters that they're still able to be made use by the hero of the story, so long as we remember that the hero of the story is God.
Yeah, that's right. And that's actually a perfect segue into some of the lessons that we're going to discuss here after this final section that we'll read here in a minute. Because one interesting thing about the book of Esther that commentators point out, and then as you read through, you'll see it's like God is not mentioned one time in the book. This is really a historical account that doesn't mention God's direct intervention, doesn't mention the name of God in the book of Esther. And so it's easy to just read a book like this and think, oh, where's God in this? This is man orchestrating this stuff. God's not mentioned, doesn't say that God did this or God did that. But we know in reading it that God was definitely there and God was definitely involved. And that's one thing we'll look at here in a couple of minutes as we wrap up in summary. All right, let's move on quickly to these last few verses here in chapters 9 and 10 as we look at the aftermath now of what has happened. And in chapter 9, verse 26, it says, "Therefore they call these days Purim, after the term Pur." And we talked about that before and how Haman had determined the day upon which he would destroy the Jews using a Pur or a die to roll and determine the day on the calendar. But therefore, because of all that was written in this letter and of what they had faced in this matter and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring who had all joined them, that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation and every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. And then in chapter 10 and verse 3, a final statement we'll look at is, for Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. And the book of Esther concludes there with just a few verses in chapter 10 talking about the greatness of Mordecai and the kingdom of Persia and his rise to power because of what God was working through him and through Esther to save the nation of the Jews. And so we've talked plenty about how Haman's plan backfired, but what I'd like to do now is get into what are some lessons possibly we can take from this book of Esther. And one is, we'll go right to the bottom of this chart here first, because Paul had kind of already brought this up. And it says God always keeps his promises. God's not mentioned in the book of Esther. But in his named absence, he still provided a way for his people, the Jews, to be saved, and therefore his purpose to be fulfilled, for the line of Christ to be preserved, for his people to be saved from annihilation at the hands of Haman and the Persians. And so in our own lives, and I think, you know, we can draw all kinds of applications to the current situation that we're in. And we can easily look around and we can say, you know, well, why is God allowing something like this virus to infiltrate our society and our world and do what it's doing? You know, why can't God wipe this out? There's so many Christians praying every day that God would take this virus away, yet he's not doing it, or he's not doing it on our timeline. He's not doing it the way that we want. He's not healing people the way we want him to heal people. And I think we have to remember that God has a plan and he has a purpose, just like he had for his people living in Persia at that time. And he used Esther, and he used Mordecai, and he used Haman even, and he used King Ahasuerus in these situations to bring about the fulfillment of his purpose and his plan. And he will do the same thing during this time, during this virus, during this pandemic. There will be good that can come out of this, whether it's simply because the testing of his people produces patience, or it provides us opportunities to be more charitable, like Josh was talking about this morning. Or it gives us a greater reliance upon God because we don't have everything that we normally have, but we still maybe have the things that we need. So many ways that we can see God keeps his promises to us. And the examples of the accounts of this story definitely speak to that as examples that we can look to and hopefully find some encouragement and some comfort in what we see happening there with Queen Esther. In addition to that, we talked about last week a little bit about personal pride. And I think this also goes hand in hand with that, in that before something like the situation we're in comes upon us, it's real easy to think, you know, everything's great. We're healthy, got a good job, things are going well, economy's robust, there's so much opportunity. You know, this is all really, really great, yet how much credit were we giving God for that? And how much credit were we taking upon ourselves and our own actions, maybe, for some of the plenty and some of the good situations that we were experiencing in our own lives? Were we taking time to realize that just like in famine, also in the feast, it's God providing? So maybe some opportunity there to take personal account of where we're at with our reliance upon God, our trust in Him, and thanking Him for the provisions that He gives us. And then I think another lesson we have here is that everyone will be judged. Haman very easily could have gotten away with what he was doing, with his self-centered, self-centric position in life, with all the wonderful privileges and royalty surrounding him, and things that he had materially and physically and powerfully in life that made him feel so wonderful. But we're all going to be held accountable one day, just like Haman was, for how we handle ourselves in this life. It says, you know, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, it says, for the things done in the body, whether good or evil, Haman obviously was an evil person, and he was judged for that. And just like we'll be judged, there's also a reward for the faithful and for those who choose righteousness, who choose to do good. Just like there was in the case of God preserving his people for his purpose so that he could bring about the ultimate salvation of his people in Jesus. And so judgment is coming. We need to be aware of that. We need to watch out for pride. But we need to have faith and trust in God and what he provides for us, knowing that he always keeps his promises. And we need to be strong and courageous, knowing that the Lord is with us wherever we go. Tommy mentioned, you know, the words of Joshua this morning in his exhortation about him making a firm stand for, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. There's so many encouraging, you know, phrases or lines in Joshua, but to be strong and courageous, for the Lord is with you. Esther needed that. Esther needed that confidence to go to the king, to make that plea on behalf of her people. And we need that confidence now when we face times like this. We need strength. We need courage. And we need the courage to help others who also are suffering and facing greater challenges than we are every day, not just in a crisis like this, but all the time. We need courage to reach out to them. We need courage to reach out to the lost. We need to be strong, and we can find that strength and that courage knowing that the Lord is with us no matter what circumstance we're in, no matter who we have to go before, and no matter how much we're struggling to get through our everyday life, or how uncomfortable or inconvenient our situation is, that the Lord is still with us. And from time to time like this, we'll be called to do hard things. But ultimately, it's our trust in God that will help us, and it's God that will deliver us. Because as Paul said in the end, God is the hero of every story. He's the hero of Esther. And he's going to be the hero of our story when that's written one day. And so those are some lessons I think that we can take from this book. And obviously we've covered it in summary. And these are some summary lessons that we can learn. But I'll open it up now if anybody else has any other comments or questions they want to present.
This, what we were saying, also makes me think of Job, back to God being the hero of the story, and that he has an intention, had an intention throughout the book of Esther, and has an intention throughout this period of time too. We're able to look at the book of Esther and see that God is working, but the Jews at the time certainly had questions, I'm sure. Where is God right now, and why is this happening? And we see in the book of Job, we're able to see what was going on. God used Job to prove to Satan and those who were with him that Job was faithful. And that was God's purpose in allowing Job to suffer. And Job never finds out why he was forced to suffer. In fact, when Job finally gets indignant and says that he would approach God like a prince, God hits him with the whirlwind and gives him 3 or 4 chapters about, who do you think you are asking me questions about what's going on in your life? Mm-hmm. But at the end, God rewards Job. And I think the lesson for us there, too, is if we're going to truly believe that God is the hero of the story, then that means that ultimately what happens to us and how we're feeling, we've got to resign to that not mattering. And what ultimately matters is, does God give the glory? Like we read in Ephesians, is are we to the praise of his glory? And there's a reward at the end. Maybe this is displeasant. It certainly is for me. But is God the hero of this story? Am I living my life right now in a way that makes God the hero to the praise of his glory? And I think that goes to the personal pride too. If we're focused on what's happening to us and how we feel all the time, it certainly makes it hard for God to be the hero of our story.
Yeah, all good points, Paul. And I think too, based on what you've just said, I think one thing I know I've struggled with a little bit over the past few weeks, and maybe some of you have too, is how to correctly frame this situation that we're in, and do it in a way so that, you know, it demonstrates our faith in God and our trust in him, and so that he eventually can be the hero for everyone, not just for people like us who believe, but for others out there, our neighbors, our friends who don't know God the way that we might, and haven't come to obey him. Is there an opportunity there for us to think about, especially in how we talk about the situation and frame it in a way that centers it on God and what he can provide and how he's helping us to get through this? So that might be something for us all to think about in this coming week, is how we can do that, because right now all we have is it's hard to get out and really do a whole lot in an active way. And so most of the interaction that we're going to have with people is talking to them or texting them or emailing them. And doing so, is there a way for us to frame with our words something that does give glory to God and frame it in a way that would lead people to put more of their faith and trust in him? Check the chat here one more time. No, how can I get to, there we go. All right. All right. If there's nothing else, we'll go ahead and conclude the class for this week. Again, next week, and I'll send out the material hopefully on Monday or Tuesday here for Ezra, as we start the first part of our study on Esther that we'll go for the next 2 weeks. So thank you again for being a part of the class. Thank you for your comments and your questions. I really, when I teach, I really enjoy interaction. And so it's hard to teach on the other side of a computer screen for me, a lot harder than it is sometimes in the classroom. So I appreciate your comments and your interaction, especially today. Thank you. And everybody go out and have a great week. And let's try and frame this to bring glory to God.